So some Rashi is a little bit late. So Ben is Manim, so my schedule is a little bit upended. A lot of responsibilities for Yamdiv, family, and Rosh Hashanah tonight. I hope, Ezrat Hashem, to go to this big gathering at the Kikar HaTufim. Trying to make sure that as Pesach comes and we celebrate Chag Cheres, that we still keep in mind all the people that don't have their Cheres this year. But a few Rashi's on Parshas Mitzara. Again, Parshas Mitzara is normally the second half of Tazria Mitzara. Still a little bit noisy in the background. I'm away from my desk, so I'm trying to find a quiet place. So there's people in the background. In any event, one of the Rashi's in the beginning of Mitzara, remember the Torah for all sorts of reasons. I mean, I think the cutest reason, I think the most dead-on reason, is that the Torah does not telegraph Lashon Hara directly as the reason for tzaras, or tzaras as the punishment for Lashon Hara, because telling us about someone who speaks Lashon Hara would be speaking Lashon Hara about that person. So the Torah, by concealing the identity of the person who speaks Lashon Hara, teaches us about concealing identities and not sharing secrets and not speaking ill and not being explicit about things that should be kept under wraps and under silence. So by not specifically telegraphing Saras as a punishment for Lashon Hara, the Torah is doubling down on trying to be quiet and not say things explicitly. So that's what I always thought is the reason that the Torah doesn't describe Lashon Hara as the chait for Saras. In any event, the Torah has a very interesting ceremony. The ceremony after the Saras becomes Tahar right away. This is the first round. 8 days later will be a second ceremony, with shaving the hair, with korbanos, with the oil, that entire ceremony. But this is the ceremony, and again, since the Matzara can't yet enter the Kodesh until these ceremonies have been performed, so all of these ceremonies are outside of the Beis HaMikdash, even the ceremony of the second round. That first round ceremony, includes two birds, which is a very, very strange menu. Excuse the word choice, but I'm just trying to think of the right words to describe it. The birds aren't eaten. One is killed and one is sent down free to the fields. As I mentioned in a previous year, it's very reminiscent of Yom Kippur, very reminiscent of Kapara. And the reason the birds are chosen, Rashi says, is Levisha Hanegoyim Bayim al Lashon Hara. Taras is a product of Lashon Hara. Shu Maisa Pitpute Dvarim. Very interesting phrase. Pitputin would be just chirping and gossiping and talking and speaking. Pitputin. It's a hard word to translate to English. Maybe if you're listening, you have a better translation. Pitputin means almost meaningless, mindless conversation. We'd probably call it in English idle chatter or babble, just talking like birds talk. Pitpute Dvarim. So since Saras is a product of Lashon Hara, which often comes from Pitpute Dvarim, Lefichach Huskaku Latara Sotzipar, and that's why you take birds, Shemefatfistim Tamed Betsivtsivko, because the birds are always chirping and making sounds and singing. So the birds remind him of the source of his chait. Now, in previous shiurim, I spoke about the difference between malicious, pre-calculated libel, where a person intends to harm someone's reputation, intends to embarrass them, intends to injure them through verbal assault. And this image of Lashon Hara, which is chatter and gossip and sitting around the Shabbos table and one thing leads to another, and I don't really want to speak about the person, I don't really dislike him, but how can you give up a nice juicy story and to be able to discriminate between the two? Sometimes when we think about Lashon Hara, and the word rechilus in particular, because rechilus evokes the image in those days they would have a whole meal in which they would exchange gossip and they would have certain hand gestures and facial gestures, as Rashi says, l'selech rachel bi'amecha, to wink and to nod, to convey information. So of course there are some times that we launch a character assassination and we try to catch someone, and try to injure someone, the classic image of rechilus. But very often it's just idle gossip, speaking about people, sharing secrets, disclosing things which are confidential. And that's why I think the birds and Rashi's image of Pitpute Dvarim is so powerful, because it's this second mode or second route towards Avodah Zarah, and it isn't as malicious and it isn't as predetermined or precalculated, but of course it's more frequent than when you get trapped in Lashon Hara more frequently through pitwood than we do through rechilas and well-designed, malicious, targeted libel and slander. Bonus reading Rashi again this year, and of course in Matzara, since so many of the Rashis are overwhelmingly technical, I always try to focus the shiur on the Rashis that are more moral, developmental, ideological. So two other things hit me this year when I reread that Rashi. Number one is that it's not just the difference between libelous, slanderous, malicious, precalculated, as opposed to mindless chatter and gossip that ends up in Lashon Hara. I think there's something else taking place. The Metzora had a very, very quiet week. Badad Yeshev Michutz Machane Moshavo. And again, his wife is allowed to be with him. There's no Isser for the wife to be with him, but there is an Isser of Tashma Shemitah, so it's likely that she probably stayed. Why would she want to stay outside of the three machas? It's a dangerous place to be. There's no hustle and bustle. There's no food. There's no... Remember, in those days, being far away from the herd presented some degree of danger, certainly in the desert. In Eretz Yisrael, obviously you left Yerushalayim, but even leaving Yerushalayim, Chutz LaMachane, outside of the wall. Again, I'm sure they had accommodations for people that had to be outside the Machane, and there were guards and sentinels there. But living outside of the walls of Yerushalayim in those days was a danger, was a threat. You courted danger. Walls protected you. So it's unlikely that he had a large throng of people. When we think about a Metzora who has many halachos that he shares with an Avel, so during the week of Avelos, it's very, very crowded, very busy. It's part of the strategy of Avelos, is to create community and interaction to somehow divert attention from the tragedy and from the loss. But the Metzora had a very different experience. And again, I don't think it was just halachic, but we really don't know what tzaras is, and it's probably not leprosy. It's probably a very lazy, inaccurate definition. But whatever it is, it's not pleasant to be around, and it's not like people were flocking to be with that Metzora and to hug that Metzora and to be in close contact with the Metzora. It's a form of quarantine to prevent whatever illness it is from spreading. So he had a very quiet week. And then all of a sudden, after the week, or sometimes 2 weeks, is finished, and he enters, or sometimes longer, enters the Beis HaMikdash, or near the Beis HaMikdash, all of a sudden these birds, and remember, they're brought alive, and they have to be positioned alive, just like the two seerim. And these birds are making a lot of noise, and they're very chatty, and they're very mouthy, and they're singing along and talking along. And aside from just reminding him that idle chatter and endless babble can lead to one thing, can lead to another, and ultimately you may find yourself, without intending it, unintentionally, unintended consequences, speaking about someone else negatively, but it's just a contrast between a quiet world and a loud world, between a world of internal thought, processing, values, and a world of just endless, endless talking. Even if the talking never becomes slanderous and hurtful, it's a contrast between silence and noise. And everyone has a different balance and calibration between how quiet they want their world to be and how noisy in a healthy way. Noise and people and activity, and some people are on the quiet side, and some people are on the garrulous side. Some people want to be with others constantly, and other people want to be quiet and be by themselves. But sometimes we speak just because we can't bear the silence, and the silence makes people uncomfortable, and we feel that we have to say something. And when Chazal say, Siag l'chachma shesika, I believe they meant that we have to learn not just how to use our tongues and how to speak and what words to use and not lashon naki and not to use nivul peh, but also how to hold our tongues and when silence is appropriate and not to feel that silence has to be broken. So I think the transformation of Metzora is not just a transformation from libel, slander, and hurtful language to healthy, embracing, and positive language, but it's also a contrast. He's meant to be in a very silent world. We'd use the word pensive and ruminating and thoughtful and contemplative, and all the value that that world provides, especially looking back at your past and being able to come to terms with your past and deal with your past and take responsibility for your past. And then he, all of a sudden, in a very, very abrupt fashion, shifts into a very loud world. And that loud situation perhaps makes him appreciate the silence he had beforehand. You don't appreciate the silence until things get very noisy. The second issue I was thinking about is that the birds chirp And most of the bystanders, in this case the human beings, I can't speak for other animals, but most of the bystanders who aren't named Shlomo HaMelech or Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as the Gemara says, don't really understand what they're saying. So it's very much an internal conversation. And still, this conversation, quote-unquote, is held up as the paradigm of Lashon Hara, that should be avoided. Don't be like these birds. They're Mefat Petim. And it struck me that sometimes we have to share information, and that information is very personal, and it must be shared in private contexts, and no one else is going to know, and we keep working with the confidentiality. But I ask myself, are we sometimes too flexible and too permissible and too allowing and too lenient in sharing information? So, for example, when someone asks you for a shidduch, or someone asks you for a business recommendation, or someone asks you for, or you have to share with a psychologist some very, very hurtful information about someone else. So in the modern world, we realize, especially in the field of psychology and mental health, that it's absolutely crucial that this be shared and this be, and people be invited into information and accessing information that could be hurtful about other people, but that information will help the patient. It's absolutely crucial. But have we become too lax? And do we share too freely? And do we feel, oh, I'm sharing with my psychologist, and I'm sharing it for a shidduch, and I'm sharing it because it's necessary? Are we careful to regulate the information flow as strictly as we can? Say, this is what I feel I must absolutely share, and this is what I feel. I know very often when I'm asked questions, more about shidduchim and professional, I walk away checking myself and say, did I give too much information? Did I share enough? Did I... And obviously with this, there's no golden rule, a general rule of thumb, but it's the doubt and the self-doubt and the questioning, which I think indicates conscience and integrity. And I just wonder if having opened the floodgates or opened the gates and encouraging private information to be shared in various contexts, which wasn't as necessary in previous generations. I don't think we needed to exchange information. I don't know about mental health. People weren't as attuned to mental health. We didn't just share as much information about shidduchim or family arrangements. We didn't just share that as much about occupation. People were not. I think the world of information has shifted on us, and we realize that to create healthy communities and healthy relationships, we have to share information, but are we being too lenient and too flexible? And just the image of the birds chirping, which again is held up by Chazal, by this Rashi, as a negative metaphor. They're chirping, and you shouldn't chirp like them. Does it also instruct us that we shouldn't chirp like them? And even though no one else understands, only the therapist understands, only the potential shadchanis understands, are we being careful enough not to disclose? Not just hurtful information, but private information. Information that people would rather keep private and not exposed to a broader public environment. Okay. Another interesting Rashi is, let me find the Rashi here, I don't have a sefer in front of me. Torah, having described the Tahara process of a person who's a Mitzara, shifts into the Tziras HaBayis in a very, very well-known Rashi. Kisavo Eretz Kinana Shani Nosein Lechem Achuzan. So this is a very classic introduction. You'll enter the land, you'll settle the land, you'll be successful in the land. But ironically, the same promising and optimistic introduction is used to describe V'nasati Neged Tziras Beveis Eretz Achuzaschem. I will afflict your homes with tziras. So it's a very jarring and jolting shift. A preface which is normally used to be very cheery and triumphant and euphoric turns very dark quickly. So Rashi says, don't worry. B'suri lahem. It is a favorable bit of information. Hashem is showering us with opportunity, even though your house is afflicted with tziras, because part of the tziras recovery for a house is to take out some of the wall and to rebuild the wall and to break down some of the wall, and you would find there treasures that the Amoraim, the locals, had hid in their walls. So again, this is a Rashi I've spoken about very frequently, and I've spoken about the obvious issues that sometimes, especially in Eretz Yisrael, the benefits we receive are unanticipated and unintended. We think one thing, and sometimes we're able to turn what seems to be a tragedy into fortune. In this case, tziras would appear to be an unfortunate experience, but it turns out to be favorable. But one particular phrase in Rashi hit me this year. Rashi says, "Lefi shehit minu amoraim emoraim matmonios shalzam bikuros batem." They would hide jewels and wealth in their walls. Kol arba'im shana shahu yisrael bamidbar. I don't have the sefer in front of me to check the actual original medrash. But Rashi, at least the version of Rashi we have, is that they hid their treasures in the wool during the 40 years that the Jewish people were in the desert. Namely, they didn't hide their treasures in the wool before Yetzias Mitzrayim. Namely, they felt invulnerable, they felt powerful enough, they felt militarily robust enough to fend off conquerors and invaders. So they were able to freely display their wealth without any worries, without any concerns. But once the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, then all of a sudden, fear started to ripple through the ancient Middle East. And of course, this is not the only example we see. We see this most clearly through Bilaam and Balak's eyes in Parshas Balak, the conspiracy they launch, the quick union between two sworn enemies to try to defeat the Jewish people. We see this in Rahab's account of Kriyas Yamsuf, when the two spies in the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua visit her, and she says, look, the entire nation is demoralized. They realize what's happening to them, and they realize it's Juggernaut called the Jewish people. They can't be halted. They can't be stopped. It's predicted in Az Yashi Yechilach Az Yashvei Pelashis Az Nifalu Olafei Adom Adei Moav Yochasei Merad Namogul Kol Yashvei Chanan, the fear that gripped all the countries of Canaan as well as the neighboring countries. And again, we're starting to recover that. I know right now I'm recording this Erev Pesach, Tavshin Pei Dalet, and the big conversation, I just was discussing this with my wife, should Israel retaliate against Iran for the horrible missile attack or not? And a lot of people are saying they should retaliate because of Harta, because people must know that if the Jewish state is attacked so viciously that they're going to receive a harsh retaliatory strike, and this hopefully will act as a deterrent. It could be true, it could be not true. This is not a forum for political conversation. But slowly, with our return to history, people are starting to fear the Jewish people, the Jewish state, the Jewish army, and a potential reprisal if they attack our land or attack our people. It's certainly something which we didn't experience or enjoy for thousands of years, as we were seen as the weak and the deplorable and the defenseless and the vulnerable. And it was a sign of, and as we say in the parak of Tehillim, the second parak of Hallel, B'seis Yisrael and Mitzrayim, B'seis Yaakov Miyam Lo'ais, Ha'isa Yehuda L'Kotcho Yisrael Ma'am Shalom Sa, the march of the Jewish people was recognized not just by the people themselves, but by the surrounding nations and, of course, nature itself as the nations moved out of the way for our people. So Rashi talks about the years that they hid their jewelry, and according to Rashi, it really began when we left Mitzrayim, and it was a shift from an earlier period in which the Amorim felt so invincible they didn't feel compelled to hide their wealth and their jewelry. One final Rashi, okay, let me see if I could pull it up here, is when a person comes and reports to the Kohen, because everything has to go through the Kohenim, and he says, Konega nirali bevayis. So Rashi says, Afilu tamar chacham sheyodeh ashu nega. Even if you're someone that knows all the halachos, and you've studied Maseches Negoyim, and you know that it's going to be tameh, Vada leivsok adavar bara loma nega nirali, you shouldn't issue a psak and say, I have a nega. Ela konega nirali. I think I may have something which may be a nega. Now this is an interesting halacha before I get into the larger, broader, not larger, but broader connotations of this Rashi. It's a halacha called Shavyeh Anavshei Chaticha Dizura. That whenever we have a suffix, we are very careful about not saying Tamei, especially with Dine Nidus, before we show it to someone of a higher authority. Because according to some Shittos in Shulchan Aruch, if you actually come and say, oh, my wife's Tamei, or I found something that could approach Nida, even if it turns out that it isn't Nidus, and it isn't something which is Tamei, once the person has said the word Tamei, then he has to abide by his word. It's a halacha called Shavyeh Anavshei Chaticha Dizura. Many listeners will be familiar from it, and it's all over Shas, but it's a Gemara in Ksuvos, Tessim and Aleph, the famous sugi of Pesach Pasuach Matzasi. Anyway, if you know the sugi, you know the reference point. So, therefore, when a person approaches the Kohen, assuming that Shavya would exist by Tzeras Abayis, which may or may not exist, he should say, Konega, and this teaches us that whenever you approach a posek, you shouldn't issue the diagnosis before you raise the question. You should say, I think this may be, because it may have halachic stringencies, if you're more declarative. But in a broader sense, what I think this is highlighting is there's a tendency, and that's why it's specifically the Talmidei Chachamim, there's a tendency for people that are very pious and very driven and very religious to see themselves in a self-demonized fashion, a way that diminishes themselves, and thinking they're very hypercritical of themselves. And it's very hard, because religion is based on submission to a higher authority, and religion is based on checking yourself and checking your conscience and living with doubt and living with humility. And there's so many elements of a religious personality and of a pious personality or character that can lead to an excessive form of self-belittlement and self-diminution and self-effacement and always thinking that you're doing something wrong, and especially when a suffix arises, to assume the worst about it, and not just something which is beyond your control, such as a neck on your house, which at least the way the Torah describes it has nothing to do with the person and his moral behavior. It just happens. But your own behavior, I probably failed and I did something horrible. And so much of Avodas Hashem is that very delicate balancing between submission, humility, questioning, doubt, coupled with confidence, coupled with ease of mind, tranquility. And I do this for a living, and I instruct a lot of 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and I see that sometimes piety gets confused with neurosis. And, of course, the really horrible expressions of that is OCD and obsessiveness and compulsion and neurosis and depression and that entire spectrum. But even when it doesn't hit those extremes, how do you build confidence, belief in self, self-expression, while still maintaining humility, while still maintaining doubt, while still maintaining submissiveness? And I could just see the picture that Rashi paints, where a person, I could see it because I know that I have those tendencies, like any person who strives to be religious, where you just assume the worst about a halachic situation, or the worst about your own behavior, and you run and you say, either literally or figuratively, nega, I have a nega in my house. I have a nega in my experience, rather than taking a more balanced perspective and not assuming the worst about yourself, in this case about the house. So three different Rashis. One Rashi about the birds, and the birds being very loud as opposed to the quiet week he had, and also the birds talking to one another where no other creatures understand, and yet it still is even though it's a closed environment, it's meant to be confidential, it's still a metaphor for the dangers of Lashon Hara. The second is the Emoraim, the locals in Canaan, hiding their jewels and their wealth, but that fear only set in and began after the Jews left Mitzrayim. And then finally, the instruction not to say nega, but kinega, nearly bye-bye, is not to assume the worst about your house, and not to assume the worst about yourself.